From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I can't tell you how many home cooks I've met who shy away from making food from other countries just because the ingredients are unfamiliar or hard to come by. And if you're one of them, I'm here to say, that's okay. That's why there are people like Andrea Nguyen.
The name of the book, Vietnamese Food Any Day, underscores the fact that this can be done whenever you want.
Andrea Nguyen is a powerhouse. She's a James Beard-winning cookbook author and a trusted authority on making Vietnamese classics at home, like pho and banh mi. With her latest book, she's on a mission to prove that making Vietnamese dishes on the regular isn't as labor-intensive as you think. It's called Vietnamese Food Any Day. I'm so happy to have you back.
Well, thank you for inviting me back.
Always a treat. When your family fled Saigon in 1975, your mother thought to carry family photos, instant noodles, which I love, and a notebook of handwritten recipes. How has that notebook inspired this particular collection of recipes and, in fact, your career?
You know, she had this little orange paperback notebook that she carried and scribbled in there. And the notebook was just partially full of recipes that she had written down and my sisters had copied down from Vietnamese newspapers and articles and things she had made in Saigon when we lived there. And when she came to the United States, she added more ideas. And she brought the recipe because she didn't know whether or not she would be able to replicate the foods that our family loved so much when we arrived in America. It includes recipes for brownies and shortbread. And for a lot of people who came from Vietnam, who escaped the communist regime there, you know, they were holding on to certain flavors and just hoping that they could retain their identity somehow and their being in this new country. And my family did that too. But when we came here, we were also so excited to explore new potential, new ideas. And, you know, a lot of that happened at the American supermarket. You know, we saw all these like amazing ingredients we didn't have access to so easily and affordably in Vietnam.
Yeah, when you originally settled in California, your local grocery store was in Albertsons. And you actually loved that, right?
I did. I fell in love with grocery shopping when I was a kid in Saigon because I would always like accompany our housekeeper. And there was a wet market and an open air market behind our home in Saigon. And when I visited Albertsons for the first time, I was like, wow, you know, it's so calm. And because our escape from Vietnam was such like this chaotic thing, I think we really like relished that calm and peace, relative peace of being in this like tidy, neat place where there was so much food that I could like freely touch because I was not able to touch things when I was roaming around the wet market in Saigon.
You talk in the introduction of when your mom first started cooking, you were relying on ingredients like le choy soy sauce, and that you couldn't get fish sauce. Talk to me a bit about the kind of substitutions she made and how new foods and old tastes somehow came together to give your family what it needed.
So the choy soy sauce, we bought a lot of le choy soy sauce because, you know, we didn't have our Nook Mam, our fish sauce. And so the food was a little off for a while. You know, we didn't have imported rice. It was Texas long grain, but it was okay. And then, you know, a lot of Vietnamese refugees of my mom's generation, they would get on the phone on the weekends, you know, when the rates were low. If, you know, if you're old enough, you remember that that's when you got on the phone and talked to people long distance. And they would trade discoveries. And one of the discoveries was swan's down cake flour. White, low-protein flour that my mom and her girlfriend swore by as a substitute for rice flour to make bánh cuốn, which are steamed rice noodle rolls that are filled with pork and shrimp and mushroom. And they made them in 8-inch nonstick skillets. The thing is that in Vietnam, they were steamed over water and they were made with freshly ground rice. But here, people are like, well, can't get that rice. But here's swan's down, and it worked fine. And she used that method up until just a few years ago when I convinced her to switch to my recipe.
You were talking about a time where supermarkets were so different than they are now. Now, you walk into a supermarket pretty much anywhere, if it's a mainstream supermarket, and you can get cilantro and lemongrass, ginger and fish sauce. That must make your job much easier.
It does. And, you know, the linchpin is that fish sauce. When we came here, you know, we didn't have access to it. But nowadays, you can find at least one brand, if not two brands. You can get artisanal fish sauce like Red Boat at places like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods. You can order this stuff online. And, you know, markets all over the country, such as like Lucky's, carries Three Crabs, which is a favorite with a number of chefs that I know, too. And so it's really quite miraculous. And rice paper, for crying out loud, right? I mean, you can find rice paper at a regular grocery store. So I took a look at that and I was like, wow, you know, the foundations of Vietnamese cooking are available at American supermarkets and mainstream retailers. And so now I can kind of like unleash, you know, Vietnamese cooking on a broader scale to more people, and hopefully they'll incorporate it into their everyday repertoire.
Because one thing I love about the book is in the pantry section and throughout in the headnotes and in the bodies of the recipes, you will tell people, okay, you can use this rice noodle, but you can also use this gluten-free rice spaghetti, which is sort of strange and amazing.
It is absolutely strange and amazing. And that's the thing of like of the health food movement, as having, you know, brought a number of game changers into the American supermarket that has enabled this book to come to fruition. And one of them is that darn brown rice spaghetti. And I use it for bún bò Huế, the spicy beef and pork noodle soup from the central region of Vietnam. And that noodle is gutsy and it's hearty. And I couldn't use like a little cappellini size noodle. Definitely not angel hair, but I needed a spaghetti noodle. And I was like looking around one day at the supermarket, and lo and behold, there's all brown rice spaghetti. And it was like bingo, and it cooks up beautifully for the noodle soup.
What courses compose a traditional Vietnamese meal?
For like a midday meal or supper, you would have a little quickie soup, what we call gan. It's not made with stock, but actually with water and a lot of vegetables, leafy greens, and maybe a little protein. Then you'd have a main course of some sort that could be a caramel braised dish that features chicken or pork or fish or seafood, and then quick vegetables, stir fry or salad, and then some rice.
You said the magic word, rice. It's so fundamental to Viet cooking. What's your preferred method of preparation?
I am so old school. For years, you know, I was cooking rice on the stovetop, and I even trained my husband, who's white, to make perfect rice too. And so he does it in a heavy-duty 2-quart saucepan, and that works beautifully for perfect rice. I do not follow the instructions on the rice packages. I totally go rogue, and I use a lot less water. But I do have to tell you that for the sake of modernity and convenience, I nowadays will make rice in a multi-cooker, like a Fagora Lux or the Instant Pot. And I push a button and I walk away.
Do you always use jasmine rice for the recipes in the book?
Mostly, yeah, I do.
So now let's move from rice itself to rice paper. I think that a lot of people really would love to use rice paper, but when they start, they end up having terrible fails. So give us some tips.
Well, first of all, when you go to the store, you're just going to find like one brand stocked. Go ahead. Take it, you know, buy and try it out. But if you have a choice, or if you're ordering from online, my favorite brand is Three Ladies. And it's widely distributed. It's on kind of the thicker side, so it's easier to manipulate, and it's made with rice and starch. The number one problem that people have with rice paper is that they over-soak it in water. I've like done this demo with, you know, 75 people walking through a line and soaking rice paper in some warm water. Even though I tell them to just lightly wet the rice paper on both sides, they drop it in the water and then they start drinking a beverage or talking to someone. And that is a recipe for failure, because the rice paper over-soaks. You can't pick it up. It becomes like this loose, you know, handkerchief kind of thing. and it actually will no longer stick or sometimes fall apart. So don't do that. Just slide the rice paper in, rotate it for a few seconds to wet both sides, then put it on your work surface, and then take a sip of that glass of wine or beer.
What are a few of your favorite fillings that you feature in the book?
Well, there's this awesome hack. Okay, the book is like full of really awesome workarounds. So in the appetizers and snacks chapter, there's this great jicama rice paper roll, and that's a Saigon street food. What I did there to fake a Chinese sausage, a lap chung, was to buy like mango chicken sausage, and then I very quickly slice it and sear it with some maple syrup and finish it with Chinese five spice. And then it gets rolled up with all the regular accoutrements, and the sauce is hoisin with some tahini in there and sriracha, and it's just absolutely awesome. But you know, you can put anything in a rice paper roll, frankly, as long as it's thin and easy to roll up.
Shaking beef, it's a favorite at Vietnamese restaurants. How can we make it at home?
Oh, it's utterly easy. First of all, like at restaurants, you know, they say, oh, you got to make it with filet mignon. It's like, yeah, choose your favorite cut of beef. You want it marbly is essentially what you want it to be. And the beauty of shaking beef and the resourcefulness of Vietnamese cooks that's expressed through that dish is that you take a, you know, piece of beef, which in Vietnam was very pricey, you cut it into smaller pieces, coat it with seasonings, and then you sear it off very quickly and serve it on top of a bed of greens that's lightly dressed. But the thing is that you can use like one piece of beautiful steak or maybe two pieces and then feed a crowd. And it's so simple to do. But I do warn people in the recipe that it can get a little messy because of the searing. And it's like sputtering and all of that. So use a splatter guard and you're good to go.
You are one of the most engaged book authors I know on social media. Did this book come out of questions that you have been getting online from cooks that are making food from your previous books?
You know, over the years, this is my sixth cookbook. People always want to know, like, how do I get the ingredients? Where do I go? And, you know, what do you recommend for Asian markets? They want simplicity. They want ease. And I feel like they also want permission. And I'm giving it to them in the sense of these are modern recipes. These are, some of them are based on actual simple foods that I had in Vietnam. But, you know, they're not the classics. And sometimes making classics, and you know this, Evan, sometimes making classics takes a lot more effort.
Yeah, it's a project. It's not a weeknight situation.
Right. You know, my overarching career goal is to really push these Asian flavors and Vietnamese food ways in particular from the margins into the mainstream. And the way that I can do that is to showcase, you know, the simplicity of it. We can do things that incorporate the ideas of Vietnamese food into our repertoire so that, hey, you know what? You can have that little quickie soup for dinner one night, and if there are leftovers, have it for lunch the next day. You can incorporate a pickle into a sandwich, and if you've, you know, you can make a banh mi with roast beef if you'd like, as long as you've got the Vietnamese pickle around. So it's that kind of cross-cultural cooking that I really see being the future of America, is how we eat and live today. And I can only make that point if the ingredients are readily available and if the techniques are really straightforward.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you, Evan.
That's James Beard Award-winning author and cooking instructor, Andrea Nguyen. She's been talking to me about her latest cookbook, Vietnamese Food Any Day. Coming up, the former editor of Lucky Peach talks to me about how eating reveals what we have in common. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. The late Maya Angelou wrote, quote, "We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike," unquote. And despite the deep political divisions running through our country, we at Good Food have known for years that food is a democratizing force. What we eat and how we do it binds us together, even across wildly different geographies and cultures.
I might feel repulsed, actually, by eating a grub or a mealworm, but I feel this pride in what my species is able to do.
That's Chris Ying. He's a Bay Area food writer and former editor-in-chief of Lucky Peach magazine. Chris is a firm believer that food shows us what we truly have in common. It's the premise of a book he edited called You and I Eat the Same. It was named one of the best food books of 2018 by The New Yorker and The Guardian. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Evan. How's it going?
It's great. It's so interesting. It's a collection of essays. It's also fascinating within the essays, as you read through them, how there's this play back and forth between the idea that sort of no ingredient belongs to anybody because all ingredients belong to everybody because of just the huge amount of movement there has been over history of humanity and with them, all different kinds of plant material and ideas for cuisine. Also the way that people who make a point of making themselves be a part still can't really be a part. So let's take as an example the essay about the Mennonite community in rural Mexico. Maybe you can sort of talk to that a bit.
That's kind of this extreme example. Mennonites culturally want to preserve their way of life and sort of keep it from outside influence. And throughout their history, they've spent centuries moving around the world, trying to isolate themselves and allow themselves to be disconnected.
Yeah, it's like they're running away from modernity.
They're running away from modernity for sure. But, you know, there's this community of them in sort of a rural part of Mexico, in Durango. You know, the Mexican government was sort of happy to have them come and live their separated life. But this writer, Michael Snyder, went to visit them there, and he found, you know, these dairy farmers who had made this very specific and directed goal of separating themselves, living this life that was just so fully integrated with the Mexican community around them. You know, there are chilies on the table and hot sauce on the table at lunch, and the cheese they make is called, you know, queso Menonita, and it's like sold to all of the local families. When the young people want to kind of get away from day-to-day life, they go hang out at the Mexican restaurants, and there are all these culinary collisions that, even in this community that's trying desperately to separate itself, are unavoidable. And it just happens that those connections happen through food.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And the pictures, the photographs just really reinforce it. There's one photograph where the table just looks like German Midwest food, but then of course there's all the chilies on the table.
Yeah, exactly.
The other types of essays that are in the book that I really loved were the essays that sort of round up likeness through different food traditions, like the one that centers on banana leaves. I think it's called Leaves Make Things Steamy. Such a great title.
Yeah, so when my editorial partner, Erilyn Beaumont, and I sat down to test this hypothesis a little bit, this idea that you and I eat the same, we sat in a room and tried to come up with these threads that cross over time and geography, these things that emerge, techniques and flavors and ingredients that just seem to, if you're in the country, you feel like this is our thing. You know, tamales, this is wrapping things, steaming masa in corn husks or banana leaves, that's a Mexican thing. But you zoom out a little bit and you see like lots of different cultures have independently or maybe not independently come up with the same thing. You know, in Chinese, you have zongzi, you know, like you have sticky rice wrapped in lotus leaves and steamed. These things aren't restricted to who you are as a person. And that's the sort of important thing is because if you start to believe that these differences are really important, you can start to believe that they're fundamental to the person, that people are fundamentally different and therefore worth more or less. And so the more we can kind of demonstrate that it doesn't matter, that technique and food can transcend them, the more I hope we can start talking to one another from a place of common ground.
Yeah, the other sort of listy essay akin to that one that I really loved was The Flatbreads Wrapped Around Meat.
Yeah, I mean, just sit there in a room and think for a second about that notion of a piece of flatbread wrapped around meat. Like, the more you sit there, you're going to come up with more and more and more ways in which this very basic combination occurs in human nature. Tacos, shawarma, gyros.
It's pretty endless. And sort of growing out of this idea, because often the flatbread and the meat that go together went together because there was no silverware involved. People weren't dealing with forks. People were using the flatbread as a way to pick up the meat. There's another piece that looks at how the woman who wrote The Rituals of Dinner, which was just an incredible, groundbreaking piece of food anthropology or food history, came to the idea of how etiquette and mores also are used to make us seem the same or to set us apart.
Yeah. This woman, Margaret Visser, has been studying etiquette and foodways for decades. And a writer named Wendell Stevenson went to go sit with her and just talk about this. And, you know, we wanted to kind of understand this idea of dinner etiquette and civility and ritual that can like sometimes be used again to separate us, you know, like in many Asian cultures, slurping your noodles, slurping your soup is totally acceptable, if not, you know, preferable. It's a sign that you're enjoying what you're doing. Whereas at a Western table, as a kid, you might be taught, like, don't slurp, don't make noises. The point is that there are these kind of ritualized things, and that dining has ritual even in, you know, what we would consider to be like the sort of most base form of eating, which is cannibalism. Even within that, there are these highly ritualized rules of etiquette.
There's one essay called People Will Eat Anything, and it's an alphabetical litany of things that we collectively put in our mouths. And it includes black palm weevil, harp seal, Louisiana crawfish, and West African manatee. Why include a list like this of species that we consume?
Beside it just being sort of fun in like a weird Dr. Seussian way to read, the entire piece sort of hinges on the first two words, which are we eat. I didn't want to make a list of things that are eaten in one place versus another. I wanted people who eat beef to feel like they were part of the same human tradition that eats snails. And as humans, we will eat practically anything.
We will eat anything. And the idea of disgust or pleasure is so nuanced and contextual. If you strip that all away and you just have the list, what it really does is reflect on how ingenious and strange we are as a species.
Exactly.
Then there's another type of essay, one that Krishnendu Rai and Paul Friedman's are an example of, where they explore cultural dietary taboos, the introduction of immigrant cuisines to a non-immigrant palate, and also appropriation or misappropriation. I feel like their essays sort of focus on very hot-button issues right now. Do their words draw any conclusions as to whether exposure to foods of other cultures dispel any prejudice?
They try to. The difficult thing about this, Evan, and this conversation is more alive where you are in Los Angeles than probably anywhere in the country, where you have this very, very rich tradition of what most people would traditionally call ethnic restaurants. And you also happen to be in the hotbed of modern American dining, where everybody is borrowing from one another or taking from another or however you want to see it. The short answer is no. You can be a racist, horrible monster and still like to eat tacos. You can go to a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, and still feel this kind of disgust toward the people who are serving you the food. Sharing one another's food is not going to necessarily engender understanding. That being said, for those of us who are trying to grapple with these issues of what's okay and what's not okay, how do I approach somebody else and not be like some kind of colonial explorer, like planting my flag in like a hole in the wall Oaxacan restaurant or something? Christian Ndu and Paul have some very interesting things to say, you know, starting with that notion that you just said, which is appropriation and misappropriation. I think that term culinary appropriation, cultural appropriation, gets thrown around a lot. And it's because of that feeling of ownership and pride that people feel in their traditions and the sort of sense of theft or loss they can feel when somebody else is trying to do it. But I have a hard time seeing any culture as not appropriative. That's how culture is created. Krishna Ndu sort of singles out this phrase misappropriation, which I think is kind of a better term for those exploitative uses of other people's food or the ways in which people are very venal and kind of opportunistic and don't think about the history or the context for what they're doing. It's a long-winded way of saying, like, this is a really hard conversation because there are no straightforward answers. There's no way for me to say, yes, it's okay if a white guy cooks kimchi if he's been to Korea 3 times. Like, I don't have those rules for you. The best we can do is to continue to have the conversations and not be so quick to jump on one another, I think. Certainly, we're not going to create more understanding between one another if said white dude chef tries to make Korean food or Chinese food and is immediately drawn and quartered. That chef's instinct is not to go out and try to study Asian foodways better and understand people better. It's going to be defensive. I think that those two essays are really important for moving the conversation forward, but I have not come to the answer yet.
Well, when can we expect to see the next book in the series? And would you give us a tease as to what it may cover?
Yeah, I don't know when you'll see the next one. Hopefully in the next year. We're going to explore different topics. I think we've talked a lot about technology, a lot about the ways in which technology has not only affected the food world, but sort of affects all of our interactions. And that's a space I really want to play around in.
Well, thank you very much for this one, You and I Eat the Same. Thank you, Chris Ying.
Thanks, Evan.
That's Chris Ying, founder and former editor-in-chief of Lucky Peach. We've been discussing You and I Eat the Same, the first in the Dispatches book series from the people who brought us the Mad Symposium in Denmark. After a break, we're going back to the turn of the century, London and Paris, to be exact. Stick around for the story of how César Ritz and chef Auguste Escoffier combined forces to make the world's first luxury hotel. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Let's time travel back to London, around the turn of the century. It's the Belle Époque, and World War I hasn't happened yet. The British aristocracy is powerful, yes, but things are changing. Women are gaining more independence. There is a rising middle class, and Americans are traveling to Europe in greater numbers, flush with new money, industrial wealth. The symbol of these rising fortunes is Savoy Hotel in London. It's a palace of luxury, the first hotel in London to have electricity. In the dining room, you might see actress Sarah Bernhardt, Oscar Wilde, or even the Prince of Wales. It was the world's first luxury hotel, masterminded by two men, Swiss hotelier César Ritz and French chef Auguste Escoffier.
They look like characters from a whole entirely different world. And yet, once I started to do my research, it really struck me that they were just exactly the kind of ambitious, young restaurateur, hotelier types that you see today.
That's author Luke Barr. He's been talking to me about how Ritz and Escoffier joined forces to create the world's first luxury hotel. It's the subject of his book called Ritz and Escoffier, The Hotelier, The Chef, and the Rise of the Leisure Class. So when did the Savoy debut, and who was behind the project?
The man behind the project was a theater producer named Richard Doyley Cart, who had opened the Savoy Theater on the Strand in London in 1880 and was tremendously successful putting on the Gilbert and Sullivan comic operas, and so successful and making so much money that he decided that he would open a modern hotel. So that happened 10 years later, and he was an interesting character in his own right. You know, he had put on these Gilbert and Sullivan operas and brought them to the United States. And he toured around America visiting various cities, San Francisco, New York, all over. And he realized that the hotels that he was staying at in the United States were just fundamentally superior to anything that was that existed in Europe. They had electricity, they had elevators, they had electric lights, they had toilets, they had hot running water in every room. And he decided to bring that to London. So he got the money and he opened the Savoy Hotel in 1890.
It's so bizarre to realize that hotels at that time in Europe, if you wanted to take a bath, there was a contraption made of canvas that would come out from the bottom of your bed and get filled up with water.
The whole bathroom thing is phenomenal. Wealthy people had servants, so they could call for hot water and it would be brought up to them, and they could call for anything they needed. That's all kind of changing at the end of the 19th century, where people are becoming more mobile. They're traveling from their country house into London, and they don't necessarily want to bring all of their servants. I mean, you've seen Downton Abbey. People are traveling more without the staff. And so the hotels need to sort of step up and do those jobs. D'Oyly Carte realized he could build this incredible building and it could have American elevators in it and it could have electricity. And it did have all those things, but he needed something more. He needed to attract the kind of elite cosmopolitan European traveler. And that's why he reached out to Cesar Ritz, who was this up-and-coming 39-year-old hotelier in the south of France, who knew all the various aristocrats and in Europe. And he wanted Ritz to come and join him in this venture in London. And that turned out to be a crucial part of the story. One of the reasons Ritz was so successful was because he had partnered with Auguste Escoffier, the great French chef, and together they had invented a new style of hotel and hotel restaurant in the south of France and in Switzerland that catered to this elite European clientele. And D'Oyly Carte wanted them to come to London and help open the Savoy and make it a success.
And they're sort of thrown into this situation where they're expected to take an already existing place and bring it to this next level of luxury. Let's focus for a minute on Ritz and his particularly amazing character. And having just watched the Netflix show 7 Days Out, which shows the week before Daniel Hume and Will Guidara reopen Madison Park, the similarity in personality type is just fascinating.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen that show, so I obviously need to watch it. I have to say, that's something that really struck me as I was working on this book, was just how contemporary and modern the characters seem to me. And I'm talking about the psychology of the characters. Ritz in particular, that sort of outsider who wanted to be an insider. You know, he came from nothing. He was the 13th or 14th child of a peasant family in the Swiss Alps. And he came up as a waiter, started off at age 13 as an apprentice in a restaurant, waiting tables, and gradually worked his way up to being a maitre d' and eventually managing hotels for other people, other owners. And then eventually going out on his own and getting his own investors and opening his own hotels, partnering with Escoffier. And all the while, he's filled with a kind of feeling of inadequacy. He's part of this world of supreme wealth and luxury, and he's providing this incredible level of service. And yet he always feels like he's not quite part of that world. Another thing that struck me that seemed very contemporary was just the level of kind of systematic thinking about what is a great hotel experience? What is a great restaurant experience? They, both Escoffier and Ritz, they kept records of their clientele. They kept track of what any person who came to the restaurant, what they ordered. If the Prince of Wales, you know, ordered a particular kind of chicken dish one time that he was there and he loved it or he hated it, they kept track of that. If you showed up at a Ritz hotel and you requested sparkling water rather than flat water on your bedside table, or you preferred this kind of pillow, he kept notes about all these things. That's very contemporary feeling to me. It's striking that it actually began all the way back in the 1890s.
He was an absolute perfectionist, and no element of the hotel experience was too small for him to make sure that it was done to his standard.
Right. He was fascinated with design and lighting. that whole idea of to see and be seen and the theatricality of the restaurant experience, again, that's something that Ritz was a sort of seminal figure in figuring out and thinking about the lighting, the how you entered into a restaurant. What would a woman in a ball gown look like as she descended or ascended the stairs as she was coming into the room? All the details about that were things that he thought about obsessively.
So let's talk for a minute about Escoffier. What was his background?
He similarly was a working class guy from Provence. His father was a blacksmith. He was a small man, and he came up in the rough and tumble of restaurant kitchens at the time,
which were brutal.
Very brutal, really hot, smoky places with coal ovens. And he's this little guy who's, you know, too close to the flames. So as he became more successful, he kind of wanted to change that culture. He changed the food on the plate, and I can talk about that. But he also changed the culture of the kitchen in interesting ways, calming the kitchen down. He didn't want all the yelling and shouting. He didn't want the drinking. He wanted chefs to be wearing clean white uniforms. He instituted this idea of self-respect among his staff. Most importantly, he kind of really advanced the basic kind of division of labor that happens in a restaurant kitchen. I mean, it's not that he invented that entirely, but he definitely systematized the division of labor inside of a kitchen so that food could be prepared quickly and accurately and come out the same every time, which enabled them to produce a la carte dining so that you could show up at the restaurant and order food and it would come out, rather than the sort of previous style, which was the banquet style, where you have all the food coming out at the same time and being carved at the table and piled high. He was sort of simplifying the classic haute cuisine dishes and serving them in this new a la carte style.
One of the things that really, that I had no idea that it was Escoffier's doing was this idea for him. He called the changes that he made in the kitchen, civilizing the kitchen, and it was really important to him that the cooks, which before were seen kind of as bums, were professionalized.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to talk for a minute about the menu. So he started making the menus all in French. They were a la carte. But there was some confusion. So he also created the prefix menu.
Exactly. You would call the restaurant to make your reservation, and then there would ensue a conversation, not with Escoffier directly, probably, but with his maitre d' Echenard or with one of the other people who worked there. And they would talk about, well, how many people are there in your party and what do you like, what do you not like? Oh, how about why don't you try this appetizer? How about this fish? And then he would create a prefix menu. These became incredibly popular among the English who, you know, you have to remember, great cooking at this moment was French cooking, of course, but they didn't really know or understand it particularly well, and they didn't really know how to order off of a French menu necessarily. Some of them certainly did. But this prefix menu that Escoffier kind of popularized allowed them to just have a sort of pleasant conversation, and then everything would be delivered in perfect order. And he gained this reputation as sort of this incredible chef who could give you exactly what you wanted without you even knowing how he did it.
A big part of the story is the scandal, which, following an anonymous tip, Ritz and Escoffier are investigated about their business dealings. What was the outcome and the repercussions?
The outcome was that they were fired. They were sending groceries home. They were supplying their own private homes with the groceries and the food from the restaurant kitchen. They were taking kickbacks, or at least Escoffier was taking kickbacks from his major suppliers. Ritz, meanwhile, was developing his business. He only worked at the Savoy half of the year, and the rest of the time he was developing his own hotels and entertaining potential investors in those hotels and businesses at the Savoy, and giving them all kinds of free wine and signing their checks and allowing people to run up huge tabs. So they had made the Savoy a tremendous success, the likes of which had never been seen before. And they acted as if they owned the place. But the truth is they were not owners. D'Oyly Carte owned it, and they were employees. There's the crux of the scandal right there, is if you have these guys who are acting like owners, but they're not, then the owner decides this is not acceptable. Here they are entertaining, you know, potential investors in a competing hotel in Paris or whatever, and so he throws them out. So they leave along with the entire kitchen staff, and they decamp to Paris, where the plans for the Paris Ritz are already underway. And just a brief moment to contemplate that, that Ritz, who was a working-class kid from Switzerland, was now opening what was going to be the premier luxury hotel and restaurant in Paris. This is in 1898, and he's calling it the Ritz. That's a kind of shockingly audacious thing to do, let's say. And, you know, a lot of the investors that put up the money for the Paris Ritz had also invested in the Savoy. And, of course, they knew how talented he was at the Savoy. So you can see why D'Oyly Carte was decided to fire these guys. You know, they basically just opened the Ritz in Paris and had another amazing success in Paris.
Thank you so much, Luke. It's a great book.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Luke Barr, author of Ritz and Escoffier, The Hotelier, The Chef, and the Rise of the Leisure Class. Now we turn to a luxury hotel from the present day. Last year, the Nomad opened in downtown Los Angeles to much fanfare. And like the Savoy, it's the product of a famed partnership, chef Daniel Hume and restaurateur Will Ghidara. LA Times food critic Patricia Escarcega recently reviewed the Nomad's restaurant for the LA Times, and I wanted to hear more about her experience. Hi.
Hi, Evan. Great to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. Give us some background. Whose restaurant is Nomad?
Yes. So anybody who's familiar with kind of the New York dining scene will be familiar with this team. It's chef Daniel Hume, restaurateur Will Ghidara, and together they're the team behind one of the most famous restaurants in New York, 11 Madison Park. And they've kind of created a very popular brand with Nomad. It's a hotel, boutique hotel, and it's also a restaurant. Opened in New York. The Los Angeles location is their big, splashy LA debut.
And it was their first debut outside of New York.
That's correct, yes.
On their way to world domination.
On their way to world domination. They just opened a new Nomad hotel slash restaurant in Las Vegas last fall. And I think the brand is growing. I think it's fair to call it a brand at this point.
So let's talk about, I love it, you say, in a year swollen with new restaurants helmed by chefs from elsewhere. So Daniel Hume definitely is from elsewhere. Who is the chef de cuisine?
The chef of cuisine is Chris Flint. So he's been there from the very start. And he oversees a very large menu. I call it kind of a hodgepodge of Nomad's greatest hits. A lot of the dishes that you get kind of will turn into a taco-making party on the table.
What do you mean by that?
So they have this great Santa Barbara sea urchin service where it's kind of a mashup between a traditional caviar tray service and a taco-making party. You get these fishy nori crepes, and then you get a lot of really interesting toppings. You have the gooseberry relish. You have a salty bonito cream. You have some pickled radishes, and you kind of roll it up. And this is something my server told me. You kind of roll it up like a taco. It's a lot of fun. That dish shows up on the menu. Sometimes it goes away, but if you see it on the menu, it's a fun kind of communal dish that's fun to do with like a group.
So a lot of people, the dish that's probably the most Instagrammed from there is the truffle chicken.
Yes.
The famous $92 truffle chicken.
Yes.
But that relied pretty heavily on foie gras.
Correct. So shortly after this review was published, the foie gras ban was upheld here in California. So now I say in the review, they took it down to a measly, I think, is it $62 Nomad chicken? I don't know. I'm curious what the feedback is from diners who have tried it. I haven't had a chance to try it yet, but it was their kind of signature dish. It was padded with foie gras. It was exceptionally juicy. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out on the, you know, Nomad menu and with customers.
One thing that struck me, one of the images from the review in the LA Times was a plate of ceviche.
Yes.
One of the things that struck me was the technique involved, those beautiful little perfect dice. So even though it's something that we may have eaten a million times in a million places, definitely technique is on display here.
Oh, certainly. It kind of comes out on ice and it's very, very fresh. It has a fennel aioli. It's very fragrant. It's the kind of dish that you put on your tongue and it just sort of dissolves like sugar. It's really good. I think it's one of their best sellers. And it's think's the dish that you'll always find at Nomad. The menu changes a lot there. Over the course of 2 weeks, I think I went 4 times, and every single time I got a different menu. But the kempachi ceviche is something that was always on the menu.
So was the chicken your favorite dish?
You know, I have a great appreciation for the chicken. But as I say in the review, the LA Times review, I really lean towards the duck. They have a magnificent duck that has this exceptionally crispy skin. And again, it turns into a taco-making party. Another improbable taco-making party. So the roasted duck, part of it is sliced into the pre-sliced breast, which is really juicy. And then part of it is kind of like shredded duck. And it comes with sitar spiced rolls and a really delicious salsa verde. And you kind of create little taco duck rolls with it. Again, it's a hodgepodge. You get great seafood. You get great pasta. They also have a lunch menu, which kind of leans more towards burgers. They have fish tacos. Pretty good standard kind of hotel fare. But if you could swing it, you really want to do dinner at Nomad.
So this is obviously a pretty luxe experience. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the building, the room?
I think one of the big things working in Nomad LA's favor is the space. If you want to go somewhere and sit in just an incredibly luxurious, beautiful space, this is a great place to do it. And as with other Nomad restaurants, it has several spaces. So you have the lobby. If you go upstairs, you have the roof deck bar and kind of a really casual, more casual seating area. And then you have a whole separate bar downstairs. And the whole space just feels incredibly swanky, kind of soft. You have a lot of dark velvet purple everywhere, just a very soft, dim space. There's a spot in the lobby where I was told people duck in just to take selfies for Instagram. There's this great natural light coming in from the outside. And just the upholstery, everything is touched with like this neoclassical Italian. You know, you feel like you're in a 19th century villa, your rich uncle's 19th century villa. It's a very beautiful space.
I understand that there's a plate of bucatini that's not to be missed.
Yes. The bucatini pasta has a kind of a uni sauce laced into it. So you get like a kiss of that sea essence, but it's still incredibly rich and buttery. Really probably one of their strongest dinner items, I would say.
Almost like an uni carbonara.
Yeah, an uni carbonara. That's a great way of putting it.
And what about dessert?
Nomad is famous for its milk and honey dessert. It has honeycomb brittle ice cream. If you like milk and honey, this is a dish for you. It has this creamy textural thing going on, but then you also get the crunch from the honey brittle. Really, really beautiful marriage of flavors. It just really disappears off the plate.
Well, thank you so much, Patricia.
Thank you, Evan.
That's Patricia Escarcica, restaurant critic for the LA Times. She's been talking to me about the Nomad Hotel in downtown LA. I'm pleased to say that she and LA Times critic Bill Addison will be visiting us each week to discuss their findings. Be sure to tune in each week for a new restaurant review. In a moment, the market report with our favorite gal, Laura Avery. Don't go anywhere. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Finally, we close with a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Here's our friend Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking now on this bright sunny day with Naisha Arrington, who is chef partner at Native Restaurant. Naisha is a well-known restaurateur about town. Native is her latest passion project. And you're at the market with your big smile. Tell us what you're shopping for today.
Well, today I'm in the market for some goat cheese. Very excited about sourcing from Drake's today.
Drake Farm, yes.
Yes, ma'am.
They're one of the last Southern California located in a Chino, Ontario area.
Yep.
Goat farms.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they have, I guess, several varieties. What kind of cheese are you looking for in particular?
I'm looking for a goat cheese that is, it has amazing sort of tang and texture to it. We're just going neutral flavor as we're going to add some amazing components to what we're doing with it is a toast. So I use the Red Rooster Bakery there here in Santa Monica. And so we grill the bread and we just simply whip the goat cheese and add a little bit of lemon zest, some thyme, and we make a melange of roasted mushrooms from Shiitake Happens and sort of pile those onto the toast and then are just going to drizzle that with, we infuse this amazing honey with habanero peppers. They're these killer peppers I just started using this last year that have tons of flavor and they're not too spicy, but they have this very like mild smoky note to them. Mm-hmm. And so we just simply slice and roast them and infuse the honey with them. So I'll drizzle that over the top and it's just going to be this amazing creamy sort of like unctuous bites throughout the toast.
Sounds like breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And the, of the Drake cheese, are you using one of the soft ripened rind or the chèvre or what?
Yeah, we're going to use the chèvre. And then so the ripened rind cheeses I'll use on our cheese plates. Mm-hmm. And for this application, I like to use a little bit, just a little bit more mild.
And I know that goat cheese does have that goaty flavor, but is chèvre the mildest of them all?
Yes, and it's going to pair very nicely with the mushrooms because I really want there to be this like beautiful equilibrium between the two.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm a home cook and all I have is my Nutribullet, can I blend? How do you blend that? How do you blend that cheese to make it creamy?
That's perfect, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I like to use a food processor.
Okay.
It helps to have the cheese at room temperature. You'll get a really nice viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
You can add a little bit of olive oil also, or like lemon juice, depending on what you want to use it for. And if you want to even just like process it and leave it in the fridge, you can add like a tiny bit of cream, and then you can just sort of use that like in place of butter or put it in like an omelet or something. It's really nice as well.
Do you add the thyme and the lemon zest? Could I do that and then store that in the fridge?
Totally.
Yeah.
What I like to do is just like put it into thirds and I'll do like one sweet one. So like if I make like a strawberry puree, you can like fold that into it. So you'll have that for like French toast
breakfast
or something. Exactly. Or bagel.
Right.
And then you can add some like chives to one and like toasted black pepper. And then you can add some like chopped thyme and lemon zest to another. And then you have like, you know, these three built-in flavors into your one chèvre.
That sounds so good.
Yeah.
And Drake Farm, it's owned and operated by Dan Drake,
yes,
who's a veterinarian, raises the goats, and makes cheese. It's
so
just
amazing.
An amazing guy with three full-time jobs.
Right? Just lovely human beings.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and one of the very, very last dairy farms at all in Southern California.
Super cool.
Yeah, it is. All right, well, thanks for finding them and telling us all about that delicious goat cheese toast.
Totally my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Great to see you, Naisha. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was chef partner Naisha Arrington, who is over at Native Restaurant. It's on 7th and Santa Monica, right across from the Santa Monica Main Library. And always an adventure to go down there and see what Naisha's cooking.
Yeah.
I'm talking now with Rick Cleland, who sells the Drake cheese at the Wednesday Market. And we're at your booth now, Rick, and you have several different kinds of cheese. Can you talk about the varieties of cheese, what's the most popular, or what makes Drake sort of unique in the world of goat cheese?
Sure. So we can start with what makes us unique. We're all local, so we are the only goat farm in Southern California that makes goat cheese.
On the farm.
On the farm,
right,
of course. And we have multiple different kinds. So the specialty kinds we have is we have the two Bouchon styles, which are a blooming rind cheese, which are real creamy, a little more rich. Then the harder cheese, which is the Idlewild. It's a little bit different. It's going to be a little more like a Parmesan, like a Pecorino style. And then, of course, the chèvre, which, of course, is the fresh goat cheese, which spreads more at room temperature, is real crumbly.
It's creamy. It's
very creamy, and it's got that really nice, rich, whole flavor to it without being too strong or gamey or anything like that.
The Idlewild is kind of your signature cheese, your super specialty cheese, and is that something that a lot of traditional goat cheese makers make?
Typically not. Most people are very confused when they see a harder goat cheese because most goat cheese is going to be sold like chèvre in a log or in a cellophane wrap of some type. The Idlewild is actually a particularly hard cheese for us to make because it does take so long. It takes about 3 to 6 months to age. It has to be, you know, kept at a temperature controlled, and there's a lot of little nuance to it. But it really comes out, and you can really taste the quality.
And I bet it makes a killer, like, grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh, yeah. It melts great. You can slice it. Finding different things to use it has never been an issue for me or for, you know, anybody I've known. But it's really just got such a great body to it that it really can complement almost anything, you know, whether it's with a sweet fruit dish, with a savory herb dish, with a, you know, a simple pasta. It's always going to have that really great wholesome flavor to it that kind of just complements everything you could ask for.
Do you know what variety of goats these are?
Absolutely. They're all our own goats, so they've all been raised on the farm. And there's three different kinds. So there's the Alpines, the Nubians, and the Sonnets. Now, the Alpines are kind of a mixed breed, so they're kind of a middle ground breed. The Nubians are the big ones with the floppy ears like you're going to see on the packaging. And then the Sonnens are mostly all white, with the pointy ears. They all serve different purpose. Some are going to have higher milk fat. Some are going to have a higher volume. Mm-hmm. So we can use all the different properties to make the really great tasting cheese.
Okay, well, the cheese is delicious. We didn't even talk about the Chev, but I'm assuming that's your best selling anyway. Yeah.
The Chev is the mainstream. Whenever you see Chev or goat cheese on a menu, it's Chev. Mm.
It's delicious cheese. It really is. Well, we're glad you're here. You're at the Wednesday Santa Monica. You're at the Sunday Main Street in Santa Monica. Mm-hmm. And then probably other markets throughout LA.
Other markets around LA.
Yeah.
I'm personally in Pasadena and then even further East Lynn and Claremont on Sundays. Mm-hmm. But yeah, check our website, and our website's got all the details of which farmers markets
pictures
we're at.
Pictures of the baby goats.
Pictures of the goats, you know, and all the different projects we're working on and stuff like that.
Fantastic. All right, Rick. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Rick Cleland, and he sells goat cheese for Drake Family Farm. It's the last fully functioning dairy goat farm where they make the cheese on the farm in Southern California. Cheeses are delicious, even for those of you who don't like goaty cheese. The cheese you'll find absolutely delightful. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Before we go, I wanted to invite you bakers to sign up for KCRW's 10th annual pie contest. The children's category is back, and this year our special category is Levantine Cuisine. To sign up and learn more, visit kcrw.com/pie. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, as always, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson and Kenny Ng for their help. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.